Okay. Good morning. Guess we don't have a quorum yet, so we will get going though. We're hearing a presentation today on fiscal disparities, which I just learned this very moment is a term unique to Minnesota. Is that not surprising? At any rate, a report that, was it the 2010 statutes authorized? So we're anxious to hear the results, and I'm sure the folks in the audience are too. We'll have time for, obviously, committee questions, and then time for any folks that want to make a comment for the record that are in the audience. So welcome. Why don't we let Mr. Ouellette introduce his guests.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Eric Ouellette with the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and I was the lead staff member from the department for this project. With me are Julie Herlins and Carson Bice from the firm Tischler Bice, who we contracted with to conduct the study. As you mentioned, the report was required from a 2010 statute, and we've been working on it for about a year, and what you have before you is the final product. Before we get started, I did want to say one thing. As many of you have already heard, the original publication of the report did include some data errors that have been corrected. They didn't change any of the conclusions of the report, but some of the numbers changed slightly in the report. So what you have before you is the revised version, and I apologize for that mistake. With that, I just want to spend just a couple minutes talking about fiscal disparities in its most basic form. I know you get a primer on it at the beginning of each biennium, but it's been a while, and some of you may not spend a whole lot of time thinking about fiscal disparities. So just to give it some real broad context, unlike a lot of the features of our complex property tax system, fiscal disparities is a sharing of tax base rather than a sharing of dollars. And there are two fiscal disparities programs, one for the seven-county metro area enacted in 1971, and a more recent one in the Taconite distribution iron range up north. And that one is newer and redistributes much less tax base. So the way it works in real basic terms is that each municipality in the metro area contributes 40% of the growth in its commercial industrial tax base since 1971 into a pool, and that pool is redistributed out to various communities based on their overall strength of tax base, the equalized market value per capita. Because the contribution is based on commercial industrial growth, the distribution is based on overall tax base. Some communities contribute more than they get back from the program in terms of tax base, and others, the reverse is true. The nomenclature used in the report and that we'll be using in the presentation is communities that are net contributors and net recipients. So because of the program, net contributors end up with more tax base than they would without the program, and net recipients end up with less tax base than they would without the program. Because of the program, local tax rates overall are lower. Commercial industrial taxes are higher, higher, and residential taxes are lower. That's just a real broad impact. And I'll turn it over to Julie. She's going to go through what's in the report, and she'll get into a lot more detail about what the report has found.
Mm-hmm. Just a moment, Mr. Ouellette. Members, we do have a quorum, and we'll take the minutes. Representative Crawford moves the minutes of February 8th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. Okay, we'll proceed then with, I'm sorry, the last name was?
Herlands.
Ms. Herland.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Okay.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning, giving the presentation on the Metropolitan Area Fiscal Disparities Program. By way of introduction and overview for the presentation itself, we've gone through the introductions. I'll give a little bit of a background on the
Ms.
study.
Ms. Herland, could, for the record, could you introduce yourself and say who you represent?
Certainly. My name is Julie Herlands. I'm a principal with Tischler Bice. We are a consulting firm based in Bethesda, Maryland, in the D.C. Area. And I do have here as well Carson Bice, who's the president of the firm, and he's here to help answer any questions. And with a national perspective question earlier about fiscal disparities unique in the country, and yes, it is, and we're happy to provide some other additional information as we go through in terms of national perspective from our work across the country. I will, through the presentation, talk a little bit about, it sort of tracks through the way the report follows in terms of looking at the region, the metropolitan area region, and growth trends in the region, tax-based trends, an overview of the fiscal disparities program, recent trends over time, and then our analysis of what would happen to tax rates and taxes collected and paid with elimination of the program in the metro area. We also will touch on the residential homestead burden, how does it impact residential taxpayers in the metro area, and then the piece looking at the question of overburden, and I'll get into this in more detail in the presentation about do certain types of land uses, do they not cover the costs that they generate in terms of service needs, in terms of the revenues generated from those land use types, and we'll go through that in some detail. And then finally conclude with some policy issues, considerations, and potential areas for future research. This is a big program that's been around for a long time, and there's lots of facets to it. And just by way of introduction, I talked a little bit about our firm. We are based in the D.C. area, but we do have a national practice. The map shown on the screen shows our locations of our clients, not our offices, our main offices in the D.C. area. And so we've worked nationally, and we specialize in what we call cost of growth services, fiscal impact analysis, impact fees, infrastructure funding, revenue needs, revenue financing programs and strategies. And we have both public and private sector experience, but we really focus our 95% of our work is for local governments, the local level, with the exception of this is a state analysis, but this really does have a local component in terms of looking at the impacts at the local level. The study itself that we conducted, the elements include growth trends, as I mentioned, both fiscal and economic trends in the Twin Cities area, the fiscal disparities program itself, trends both over time and current, and then again, what happens if the program were eliminated, looking at this overburden question and looking at just in general policy questions and overview. It's not what the study is not, it's not a program evaluation. Does it work, does it not work? And then we were not asked for recommendations. It really is truly an analysis. The chances are there will be obviously further analysis and recommendations that come out of this at a later point, but this report itself was not, we were not tasked with looking at recommendations. The region that that is under analysis is the metro, the Twin Cities metro area. There's over 180 cities and townships, over 60 school districts, dozens of taxing authorities. The program itself covers seven counties. And it's interesting to note that when the program started, the MSA for the Minneapolis-St. Paul region, the Metropolitan Statistical Area, included only five counties. Today, the program or the MSA, the Metropolitan Statistical Area, is expanded to 13 counties. So the economic the reach, the market, and the reach of the job market, the labor market, has expanded since the inception of the program. In the study, what this map is showing is the Metropolitan Council, their regional development classifications, looking at types of communities. And so they categorize the communities, municipalities in the region into central city, developed areas, developing areas, rural areas, and rural growth centers. And the report itself, you can get a closer look at the report itself in the figure. But we use those groupings to do a lot of our analysis. So we're looking at not only by county level to get this higher level view, but also by these development, the types of communities to get at the impact on development common patterns. And then we also do a part of our analysis grouping the communities into net contributors and net recipients, and you'll see that as we go through the presentation. To start out in terms of growth trends in the region, what we're looking at here on the top, the top bar chart, is the share of population in the metro region by county in 2010. The bottom bar is in 1970. And what this is showing, while there's been an increase in population of almost a million people since 1970 to today, while Hennepin and Ramsey counties are still the most populous counties in the region, their share of the regional population today is much less than it was in 1970. In 2010, the share, or in 1970, the share of the regional population for those two counties was 77% of the region, and today it's 50. It has decreased to 58%. Grouping the these communities into the regional development classifications, again, the groupings of central cities, developed areas, developing areas, rural growth centers, and a portion that's excluded from the program, from the fiscal disparities program. And again, the top bar is today, the bottom bar in 1970. And what is can be seen here is the share of population in the central cities, which is St. Paul, Minneapolis, has decreased from 1970. The share in 1970 was about 40% of the region, and today it's about 23%. Increasing share shown in the developed area and the developing area in particular. Looking at growth trends in terms of employment, where the jobs are located, not where the labor force is located, but where the actual jobs are located, again, we group the communities into counties and by regional development classification. The first slide is shown by county, and the top bar, again, showing in 2010, bottom by 1970. That the share in Hennepin and Ramsey County has decreased over time, down from 89% in 1970 to 73% in 2010. And then looking
Ms.
at
Ms. Ruland?
Sure.
It's fairly hard to read even the captions under there. Could you tell us what the colors represent?
Sure, sure. The colors are by county in this slide. The blue is the first blue Anoka County. It goes in order: Anoka County, Carver County, then Dakota. The big blue in the middle is Hennepin. Then orange is Ramsey, purple is Scott, and then the final is Washington County.
So, if you could just summarize what that slide says. I don't follow here. I don't see where the same information is in the handout.
Okay, and you have you have the executive summary, and this is included in the full report, mm-hmm. The detail in the chapter on the growth trends. And so what this is showing is the shift in location of jobs by county. And so in 1970, and this is my county, Hennepin County had, for instance, in 1970, 59% of the jobs, and today it's 52%. Ramsey County is decreased from 30% to 20%, and the increases have increased in Dakota County from 4% in 1970 to 11% in 2010. The information in the executive summary shows the increase in jobs over the same period, and so it's okay. Just a shift in the way shown two different ways.
Okay.
Grouping them by the regional development classifications, and I can go over the colors. The first color, the blue, is central cities. Red, developed areas. Green is developing area. The blue skinny line, rural areas, then rural growth centers and excluded. I should also note that in the full report itself, in the first appendix, I believe it is, there's a full list of every community and where it falls in those categories, whether it's a developed area, developing area, et cetera. And that's not in the executive summary, but that's part of the appendix, the supporting documentation. So in this grouping, the point here is that the share of jobs in the central city has decreased over time from 1970 to 2010, and the share of jobs in the developed area and the developing areas have increased over time as well. Moving on to the tax-based trends in the area, to further examine how the composition of the region's tax base has changed, we analyzed county data for 1996 and 2011, and looking at the county share of the regional total of tax base and how that has changed over time. And what this slide shows, there's two bars for each category, the blue being the and this is residential homestead tax base. So the blue is for 1996 and the green is for 2011. The point here is that that most counties have maintained the same approximate share of the regional total of residential homestead tax base from 1996 to 2011, with the exception of Hennepin County, which has decreased by 3.8% in regional share, and Scott County has increased by 2.2%. Oh, I'm sorry, regional classification. Oh, I'm on my calendar. Developed areas has decreased by 9%, and developing areas has increased by 6%. There are slides within the report that show, or there are graphics within the report that show by county as well, and we have just shown by regional development classification here to shorten this up a little bit. We do the same kind of analysis with the commercial industrial tax base to show how conditions have changed over time, again from 1996 and 2011. So this slide shows the commercial industrial tax base prior to the redistribution for fiscal disparities in these regional development classifications. And so as shown, that central cities and developed areas have each lost about 4% of the regional share, with developing areas gaining 8%. And this reinforces the development trends that we discussed in the previous section regarding the outward growth of employment, that jobs have moved outward to the developing areas. The fiscal disparities program, the original objectives in the Enabling Act are shown here on the slide. There were six original objectives, and which have been commonly boiled down into two main goals: to promote more orderly regional development and improve equity in the distribution of fiscal resources. Some of the original objectives in terms of that by equalizing tax rates that you reduce the incentives for competition among jurisdictions to compete for commercial industrial tax base. That area resources are made available within the existing system of local governments, and that communities are assisted in different stages of development, from developed versus developing, that more resources are available for those communities that are developing, and developed areas are at a more sound footing in terms of their fiscal conditions. And then finally, one of the objectives was to encourage protection of the environment by reducing the fiscal considerations, so that in particular floodplains can be protected and land for parks and open space can be preserved. As Eric mentioned, that all communities contribute to a tax base to the area-wide pool, and then all receive distributions. Some contribute more than they receive and are thus net contributors. In terms of program trends over time with the program, there's some graphics in on page 15 of the report of the executive summary that describe this a little bit more. Over time, the two central cities have either been all recipients or split between recipients and contributors, and namely Minneapolis has switched between being a net recipient and a net contributor over time, St. Paul has consistently been a net recipient. Developed areas in 2011, those communities that are grouped into developed areas, are pretty much evenly split between recipients and contributors. And this is a change from the beginning of the program. We've used 1976 to show the start, the inception of the program, where there were almost twice as many recipients as contributors. The number of developing area communities has essentially remained constant over time, with recipients outnumbering contributors in at both points in time. In rural area communities, there has been a change over time. There were over five times the number of recipients as there were contributors in 1976. In 2011, today, the number of recipients has decreased, and now it's about three times the number of contributors. And all rural growth centers, those communities that are categorized as rural growth centers, are net recipients today, and they were in 1976. So part of our analysis was to look at what would happen if the program were to be eliminated. And again, we looked at this analysis by the three groupings, by county, by regional development classification, and by net contributors. So the first slide shows impacts by county, and there are page references to the report on the executive summary, pages 18 and 19, that you can get a closer look at some of the at the results. The top two figures are the tax rates, and what this is we show what the average of the current law, what the tax rates are under the current law, and then what would happen if the program were eliminated, what would happen to the tax rate. And so a couple of basic assumptions in terms of or what's included here. So the tax rates include the county, municipality, the school district, and the special districts. And there are averages in terms of the school districts and the special districts within the county. So there are averages within that for those numbers. The no fiscal disparities rate assumptions assumes the same levy. There's no assumptions made about what would happen if a community that would see a big tax increase, what if they, you know, it didn't increase to the full extent. So in reality, likely what would happen would be something in the middle here, where you wouldn't potentially levy the full amount. And the two sets of tax rate analyses are on the left are the weighted averages, combining all tax base within those counties and getting a weighted average, and the one on the right is an average essentially of the jurisdiction averages, and you do get different results looking at that way, and this is part of the complexity in terms of the property tax system in the state. To get to these numbers where you can get where there's some complexity in getting the numbers to begin with, and then looking at averages is also as another level of complexity. We also show the average rate in metro-wide as a means of comparison, and then the fiscal disparities area-wide rate also as a means of comparison. So with that, what would happen in terms of if the program were eliminated, and looking at the weighted averages, that tax rates in Anoka County would increase percentage-wise the most, and Hennepin County would be the only county overall that would see a decrease in their tax rate. The taxes paid, the bottom portion of the slide shows total taxes paid, and this is everything, all property taxes, all property taxes paid. So it does include the taxes that are paid based on the area-wide rate, and also the state property taxes. And this is in thousands. So the same results apply here. The percentages are just a little bit different because it's looking at the taxes instead of the tax rate. So Hennepin County would overall see a decrease in taxes paid with elimination of the program of about 2.6%, and Anoka County is on the other end of the extreme at an increase of 5.6%. (Clears throat) Again, we group this the communities into the regional development classifications, looking at, again, what would happen to the tax rates and what would happen in terms of the tax paid. So the takeaway here is that the rural growth centers would see the largest tax rate on a percentage basis, tax rate increase on a percentage basis at about 14.7%, almost 15%. All property taxes would rates would increase with developed areas increasing at the lowest level at less than 0.5%. And taxes paid the same.
Mr. Roland, I think we have a question from the member. Okay. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess just the last two slides, Mr. Herlins, if I've got this right, is that Hennepin County would be a net contributor and the other six would be net recipients, just based on the fact mm-hmm, that the one. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're saying, just if I've got
that right? They are. Herlins. They are currently. Mm-hmm.
And the rest would be net recipients.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Herland.
And then the third way that we looked at the impact of eliminating the program is grouping the communities by their status as whether they're a net contributor or a net recipient. And the takeaway here, and again, there's a page reference from the executive summary, page 22, that contributor communities would taxes paid overall would decrease by 3%, and net recipient communities would increase by 4.6% in terms of taxes paid.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, one thing that I would add to these three slides, thank you, is that these show the overall tax changes, but it's important to remember that in a lot of these communities, the change for commercial industrial property is going to be different than the change for homesteads, and we have those broken out in the full report. Generally speaking, commercial industrial property is going to be more benefited by the elimination of the program. Residential property would see larger increases than what's shown in the overall averages. That's not true in every community, but overall that's what happens.
Mr. Ouellette, is that available then?
Yes.
It's in the broader report, but not in the executive
yes.
summary?
On page 96 of the full report, there's charts by all types, by commercial, industrial, by residential, and then the totals, as you see here.
Okay, thank you.
And in that area.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If this is premature, and you know, as you're going through your presentation, maybe cover this later, but you know, looking at this program, since it's been in effect, are the trends in the net recipients and contributors basically following the original objective of the fiscal disparities program? Sometimes, you know, a program is begun and there are unintended consequences. So do these trends pretty much track with the original objective of the program?
Ms. Herland?
Can I think the response, we do get into this a little bit, but it depends on who's asking the question.
Well, I represent the contributors.
Okay. Yes, sure.
Mr. Roland. Mr. Roland.
There is, in all seriousness, there's a lot of... We've had a lot of discussions about this, about for every pro, there seems to be a con, and for every con, there seems to be a pro. It's very difficult, if not impossible, to determine from the inception of the program, particularly on the development, the growth trends and the impact of the tax rate, you know, equalization in terms of growth trends. It's practically impossible to undo, to control for all the other factors that would go into a location decision, a business, you know, commercial industrial location decision. It depends on, and we do get into this, it does depend on the industry, it depends on the timing, it depends on the needs. You know, retail industries have much different location needs than warehousing and manufacturing. The growth trends in this MSA, in this area, in the metropolitan area, have have followed national trends. I referenced a study by I think Elizabeth Kneebone in terms of job sprawl. It's a good paper from Brookings Institution about decentralization of job markets and the location of you know the outward growth of commercial industrial development. You know, this area has tracked along with about with the majority of MSAs in the country. If the program weren't in place, would that have been different? Potentially, potentially not. It's difficult to control for that. The question about the preservation of economic or environmentally sensitive areas. There can be an argument made for compensating those communities that can't are unable to develop those areas because of environmental constraints or preference or desire to maintain them as natural and open space. And so on a regional level, is there benefit from that? I think a lot of folks would say, yeah, there is benefit to that.
Representative Benson.
Thank you for the answer. And then, looking at the percentages changes from 1970s till 2010, we see, I had assumed that the Minneapolis, St. Paul, or the Ramsey, Hennepin counties would be similar as far as being contributors in that, but I see that St. Paul is a net beneficiary, whereas Minneapolis continues to be a contributor. Could you explain why that trend has continued like that,
Ms. Verlin?
I'll preface this by saying we did a lot of our analysis at the higher level, at the county level, and at the grouping level. But on a broad level, and Eric can jump in if he has specifics, but there is a sizable amount of non-taxable, tax-exempt property in St. Paul, which contributes to the is a factor in the formula. Correct. And Minneapolis has switched from over time, and we didn't look year over year, but it has shifted. Some points in time they're a net contributor, some points in time they've been a net recipient, it all speaks to the formula. It's a complicated formula, but it factors in your market value, population. You have lower market values, higher population, you get compensated for that, among other factors in terms of your previous levies and where the how you're locally deciding to do your levy. That's
Representative Benson, any follow up?
Well, Madam Chair, maybe we could say that those of us who represent these outer ring suburban areas who are the contributors should feel good about the fact we're helping everybody else, but we also have to represent our own constituents too, and it'll be interesting to see how I can explain this to the taxpayers in my area of the state. So we'll just leave it with that, but
all right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Crawford, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Herlands, I have a question. On the executive summary on page 20 and 21, on page 20 it talks about the total taxes and what would happen with the elimination of fiscal disparities. On 21 it talks about the rates and what they do without the fiscal disparity. On page 20, there's a couple negative numbers there. In the developed area and developing area. If you look over at page 21 on the tax rates, can you explain how you could have the tax rates not go down in any of the areas?
Madam Chair and Representative Crawford, I'll take a crack at that one. The important thing to remember about the rates is these are the local rates. The area-wide rate that commercial industrial property is currently paying is generally higher than the local rates. So when you eliminate that higher rate and you spread all the levies on the local base, that's going to have upward pressure on rates generally, on the local rates, because there's no longer this higher 129 area-wide rate that So if we had included that those higher, if we had averaged out the local rates and the area-wide rate under current law, then you'd see some net decline. So basically what you have is the commercial industrial tax base that's going into the pool, 40% of the growth since 1940, is paying at that higher area-wide rate with fiscal disparities, whereas the local, the rest of the tax base is paying at these lower rates that you see here. With fiscal disparities going away, that 129 rate goes away, and all the taxpayers are paying at the local rates. So it's not that all rates are going up, it's that all the local rates are going up and that area-wide rate is going down to the local rate average. So that the negative would be the 129 going away, and all the other ones generally are going up. There are individual communities that are very large contributors. Their local rates are going to go down. When you look at the chart on the next page, the recipient contributor, that's where you see the jurisdictions where the rate is going down. But on average, in all the other groupings, they're going up at least a little bit because this higher area-wide rate is going away.
I see. Thank you.
Really, Representative Crawford? Pretty good.
It's a page.
I know. Okay, Representative Lincheski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, when Representative Benson was asking his question about Minneapolis and St. Paul, and you know, I don't know if Mr. Hines wanted to jump in on that, maybe, or Mr. Ouellette, but I do think part of the problem with Minneapolis and St. Paul, although Minneapolis is sometimes a receiver and sometimes a contributor, I think that issue really fundamentally relies in the fact that in 1971, all of Minneapolis downtown and all of Minneapolis or St. Paul downtowns were grandfathered. And so they're sort of getting the sweetheart deal. Their commercial industrial that was developed pre-1971 is not counted, period. So, I mean, we can all remember 1971. There certainly was a downtown Minneapolis and St. Paul. And if you brought those on, which is one of the things we should reform in this program, you would see that they would be contributing much more, and the other rest of the metro would be receiving much more. So it's really a measure of, at 1971, at that moment in time, how much has St. Paul and Minneapolis grown since then? And relatively, Minneapolis has grown a lot of CI. St. Paul, relatively to the rest of the metro, has not. So I think the real answer as to why you see St. Paul continuing to get money from places like Bloomington and Minnetonka is they got the majority of their downtown is grandfathered in and doesn't have to be counted. And Minneapolis, same before 1971. So I personally think, and maybe Mr. Ouellette or Mr. Hines can respond, that's the biggest reason that we see that. But Minneapolis, as it grows, I think will continue to be more and more and more a contributor. So I just thought I would throw that in, but you know, I thought one of the issues that was missing in the study, and I know it's not the study didn't clearly ask for that, but it would have been interesting to see in these handouts that show, you know, who's giving to everybody else in the metro a statewide run, because the statewide run would show that every non-metro city, every single one, because there's a lot of rural members here and they don't really care about this program, is a recipient because of this program. Every single non-seven county metro city wins under this program, because the way that works is our LGA formula is distributed after fiscal disparities. So if St. Paul, let's say, needs $20 million based on need, fiscal disparities first might give them 12, and then the state only has to give them 8. So that spreads LGA much further around the whole state. And if you took fiscal disparities away, what would happen to the metro? That's been answered. I mean, I think it's clear that the program does, in your study, reduce disparities from a net tax capacity in the metro. I think another analysis would have been nice to see if you got rid of the whole program, what would it do to the whole state? I think all the rural members here would understand that they would now lose money too. And it's been a hard time getting legislators to understand that, because rural members tend to check out on this debate and go home and, you know, go make phone calls to constituents or whatever. But the truth is, every rural member is a huge beneficiary of this program. And I just wonder if Mr. Ouellette could comment on, you know, why there is no analysis as to how the whole state is benefiting from communities like Representative Benson and mine.
Very good. Mr. Ouellette.
Madam Chair and Representative Lincheski, thank you for that question. We have taken a look at that in the past when we've specifically had a question about that. And there is this phenomenon where the LGA, the cities in the metro area who do receive LGA would on net lose tax base if the program went away. So you would have LGA shifting out of greater Minnesota into the metro area. Currently, because Minneapolis is now a net contributor, the overall phenomenon is much smaller than it was a few years ago, because Minneapolis would actually lose LGA now if the program went away. So it's still a few million dollars, several million dollars, but it's not nearly as impactful as it used to be because of that phenomenon. But it is real. There's, as with any change in, if you change class rates or any other change to the tax-based definition, LGA is going to move around. That's the way the program works. And this program does, because it compensates some of the property poor metropolitan areas, it does reduce the need for LGA in the metro area.
Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was going to actually point out something else from the report, but I wanted to respond to Representative Lencheski. And actually, most of the development in downtown Minneapolis has happened since 1971. All those big skyscrapers, all the big hotels. I don't know, in 71 it might have been the Fauché was still one of the tallest buildings. And so I don't think it's true to say that most of the development. The other thing I would say is someone who represents probably the biggest job CI area in Minneapolis, other than downtown, those pre-71 things are no gift. I mean, I probably have more Superfund sites in my community than anyone in any legislative district across the state, and we have residential homes with, you know, pipes in the front yard to check the groundwater underneath them, and so, and they're old buildings that nobody wants to redevelop. I mean, we have tons of commercial industrial space with for sale or for lease signs, so, you know, I don't know that it's worked, but what's really been interesting to me, I mean, this report, I really looked at it, it's pretty cloudy, but there are some things that I think we should pause and look back at. And if you look at pages 4 and 5, the original goal of the program, and it was shared with us here, was to have for orderly growth of urban development. And we thought in those times that everything was growth. You know, that we didn't think about retrenchment and deterioration and those sorts of things. It was like, where is the growth going to happen? It was a really optimistic time. And if you look at over the last 40 years, you're going to, and you look down at the bottom of page 4, the population growth, the central cities and the developed areas, which I assume are the inner ring suburbs, stagnated. And then if you look across on page 5 at the bottom where they break it down by categories, it's the same thing with job growth. The central cities and the developed areas stagnated while the other areas boomed. So if the intention of this program was to allow for everyone to have success and orderly development, what we really did was enable leapfrogging by lowering the taxes in the taller areas at the expense of the central and urban areas, where we end up having to spend tons of public money doing redevelopment and having, you know, these Superfund sites and, you know, outdated buildings and whatever. And so if our real goal was to assure that everyone in the metro area had good growth going into the future, we can look back here 40 years and say this program was a failure, because what it did was it allowed leapfrogging and it allowed for stagnation of the already developed areas. And so, you know, just from a big picture, I think there's a question about whether that achieved it. But since we all love to acknowledge our House staff and how smart they are, I thought that since this is a complicated area, and for those of you who aren't from the metro area, the absolute best description of how this program really works is on page 13. It's the last sentence. And I looked at the footnote, and it was from Hines and Baker, the report of House Research. And it's that taxpayers in jurisdiction contributing more than they receive, next contributors, pay more than their jurisdiction's levy. They don't just pay what their city, their county, their schools ask for. They pay extra money and give it to someone else, to those receiving, more than they contribute. And so that's how this program really works at the taxpayer level. Is your taxpayers, if you're a net contributor, are paying more in taxes in order to lower the taxes to someone else in the metro area. And you know, we like to look and we focus a lot on city issues, but our biggest tax burden for all of us, no matter where you are in the state generally, is your county taxes. And so I would really encourage you, as you're looking at this in terms of net recipient, net contributor, to look at the county levy, because all of your people are paying more in county levies generally than they are in their city or their school levies. That is the biggest part of our property tax burden. And so if you look at that, then when you look at the simulations that are on page 18 of what would happen if we eliminated and what the disparities are, then you start to understand that, you know, the Anoka County taxpayers are getting a 5.6% break, compliments to everyone else in the metro area. And, you know, and if you live in Hennepin County, you're paying an extra 2.6% to benefit those, which, you know, in dollars adds up to about $65 million. Coming out of Hennepin County to the others. And this year, to me, that rubs a little tough because Anoka County lowered their levy by 7%, while all the other metro counties weren't able to do it as well. And they couldn't do that if they weren't getting this 5.6% from everyone else in the metro area. And so, you know, it really is easy to get lost in all these charts and stuff. But if you get down to it, it's really about, you know, one area subsidizing another area.
And we'll have time, I'm sure, for lots of discussion. So I don't know if there's more questions. Did you have a question, Representative Verrett?
Yeah, I just have a quick question. I agree with you. I wanted to wait. I have a few questions. I want to wait until we're done with the presentation. But I do have one foundational question, and I think I know the answer. But can you explain again which taxes are being shared and which classifications of, I'm assuming this is only property taxes, and I'm assuming it's all classifications of property tax, but I just want to make sure I'm totally understanding which taxes are being shared within the jurisdictions.
Okay. Ms. Herland.
Thank you. It's the tax base, and it's from commercial industrial property only, and it's property tax, property tax base.
So not residential?
No.
I would just add, though, that residential taxes are affected because of the change in rates that are caused by the shifting of the commercial industrial tax.
Okay, why don't we'll have Ms. Herland continue. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. excuse me. The next slide, this is a new figure that's not in the executive summary, but it is just pulling some information from the handouts that we provided separate from the report, but looking at the top two net contributors, net recipients in each county, and the impact of eliminating the program on the tax rate. So this is tax rate shown.
And I think this illustrates very well the importance of the county portion of the tax, because what you'll see is in a lot of counties other than Hennepin, even the net contributor cities would see a tax rate increase, partly because of the county rates going up and partly because of this overall upward pressure on tax rates from elimination of the program.
And then just quickly, one of the elements we looked at was the burden on residential taxpayers, and this is using the VOS database, which is homestead tax as percent of income, and this is median. So this is medians throughout the region. This is done by county, and the takeaway here is that we grouped them also into net contributors and net recipients. Is that net contributor communities, the homestead burden would stay the same without the program. The program are eliminated. The percent of median income paying your taxes is about 3.4%. The net recipient's burden would increase from 3.4 to 3.6%.
And important to note that that's the median. There are ups and downs on either side of that, so it's not everybody in the net recipient or net contributor communities would have those that experience.
The
Ms. Herland,
sure. The next, and this is really the final large piece of the analysis is looking at the overburden question. And this is really where our firm specializes in terms of looking at, again, cost of growth services. What does it cost to serve different types of land use? How does land use impact the ability to provide services? And again, and it comes down to the revenue generation versus the service needs. And so what we did was conducted what we call a cost of land use fiscal impact analysis. And it's looking at discrete land uses at an average basis, so an average single-family home of different property values, an average retail, office, industrial, how much revenue is generated, and what kind of costs are demanded, costs for services and infrastructure demanded for that particular type of land use. We did two different scenarios, looking at what the current system is with fiscal disparities program intact, so what the tax rates are under that scenario, and then a hypothetical scenario if the program were eliminated and adjusting the tax rates in that way. None of the other revenue sources were adjusted. Now, there would be impacts on the LGA we talked about, but we wanted to keep that constant to see what the impact would be just eliminating the fiscal disparities program. Just as a note, so this is a fiscal, a fiscal impact analysis, different from an economic impact analysis. A lot of communities will do that as well. It's very important. What's the spinoff? What's the impact to the economy? How many jobs are created? You know, you develop, you have a new headquarters for a company, you're going to have spinoff impact on retail development, and lots of more money flowing within the community, but this is really looking directly, direct revenues, direct expenditures. And the bottom line is there enough? Are there enough revenues generated to cover the expenditures? And do you get a net surplus in that case if there is, or a net deficit if there isn't? the main questions here are what type of development pays for itself, or does development pay for itself? And then is there, by extension, an overburden to different levels of government, particularly on the non-residential side? So this question of our local governments able to cover their expenditures with the fiscal disparities program, and then if it were eliminated, would that improve the situation or not? Some of the just general in terms of caveats, limitations of the study itself is that it is an average type of an approach. So again, you do have extremes for really high-end commercial industrial development that's going to generate a lot more revenue than potentially the average, or on the flip side, the lower end. Again, two scenarios analyze the current system, and then with fiscal disparities and hypothetical. For the current system with fiscal disparities, we do allocate the distribution levy. So the monies that are coming back to these communities through the fiscal disparities program, allocated it using the formula that is used to determine what that distribution is in the first place. So the key factors are market values and population. So it gets residential land uses, and you'll see in the results, get credit for that revenue. And again, other revenues are not adjusted. And we do not make assumptions also on a levy back situation where we're just using maintaining the same levy and not assuming that communities would adjust if they had to increase their levy too high. I will use this as kind of talking points for the first slide. So all of these images, the figures, are in the executive summary and the full report. So this first series is looking at what we looked at were four case example communities from four categories. A central city as a net recipient, looked at a developed area, developing area, and a rural area. And we looked at each level of government, the main levels of government, the municipality, the county, and the school district. And I'll explain what you're looking at but I want to say, so in the executive summary, the pages numbers are 28 to 29, and the full report, the analysis starts on page 112. So what you're looking at here are for each type of land use, the results for different levels of government. And the results here are shown in a way combining all revenues minus expenditures. So a bar above the zero line is a net surplus, indicating that there is that land use covers its expenses. if the bar is below the zero line, it dips below, then it's indicating that the revenues do not cover the expenditures, and there is a likely an over, quote-unquote, overburden for this particular type of land use based on the assumptions that we use in the analysis. We show, the orange bar shows the results for this at the city level, so the city government, so the revenues generated at the city level minus the expenditures to serve that type of land use at the city level. The blue bar shows the county results. The green shows the school district results. And then the hatched bar is total, so combining all total. Now, one note here is that there's really two different perspectives to look at the results. One is from the local jurisdiction level. So if you're a city and you have a net deficit, that's your reality. So there's, you're looking at it from the city, county, or school district level. The total result, a reality is that the surpluses at one level wouldn't be rolled over to another level of government. So if you have a deficit on one end and a surplus on another, you're not going to combine and have a total pot of revenue to make up for the shortfall at the other level of government. But from a taxpayer perspective, the issue is that the total reflects, you know, your burden as a taxpayer, that you're paying taxes. Are those taxes in total covering the service needs for that type, your type of development within your community? So, for this example, and I should also say too that it's interesting to compare with the fiscal disparities and without the fiscal disparities program, and you can do that in the report. It's difficult to put both slides on one, or both figures on one slide, so I have to sort of toggle between the two. The residential prototype land uses that we looked at, we varied the income or the property values. So there's a few different single family types of units, but for this community, pretty much all single family or pretty much all residential tends to produce net deficits unless the property values are high enough to offset the expenditures. For non-residential uses, the overall fiscal impact is positive in total, but in looking at the results at the city level, for example, retail development in this community does not pay for itself, or there is an overburden for an average value of retail in this city. If you take away the fiscal disparity program, what happens is that in this community, the tax rate would have to increase. And so there's a higher tax rate, and on the non-residential side, an elimination of you're gonna tax the full amount of the property as opposed to the 60% of the development. But what's interesting is that even without the program in this community, the retail development shows a net deficit. But in total, it's very similar with the program. Without the program, that non-residential uses show a net positive, and that is not an overburden. Again, with the exception of institutional land uses. We looked at developed city. The next example was a developed city. And with the program, the results are somewhat similar to the central city with a few exceptions. But with all jurisdictions combined, in total, all single-family residential land uses produce net deficits except for single-family detached units, higher value. Multifamily, in this case, we looked at a condo-type development, generates the smallest net deficit, the smallest burden. And this is due to relative household size and numbers of students per unit. So the driver behind the school results are looking at students off of the unit. All non-residential units in total produce net surpluses, again, with the exception of institutional uses. In total, it appears that there's not an overburden to serve these types of land uses. Again, the results vary by jurisdiction level, where, again, on the retail development shown is a net deficit or an overburden at the city level. looking at removing the program for residential development, the results are essentially the same. However, the magnitude of the deficits are greater, assuming the elimination of the program. In this case, the property tax rate would decrease. This is a net contributor, and so the property tax rate would decrease, and so the impact on residential land uses would be worse. The impact would be worse in terms of the fiscal impact. And on the non-residential side, without the program, the results are better, higher surpluses. But again, the retail development is still showing as a net deficit or an overburden, even with elimination of the program in this community. For the third example is a developing city that's a net recipient, and results are again somewhat similar on the residential side to the other communities where residential development tends to overall be a net deficit or an overburden, with the exception of single family units that are of high enough value to cover the costs. On the non-residential side, the results are different here, in that for retail in total, for in this community, that there is a net deficit or net burden, and this is due to the impacts on the city and the county level. School districts do provide enough revenues. Obviously, there are no costs generated on the non-residential side. Office also is different as well, with an overburden on the city and the county side, and essentially breaking even in total. Without the program, in this community, it does have an impact, and it does flip the results on the retail and the office side, where retail industrial continues to pay for itself, but now retail and overall and office do cover their costs. Again, there is the continuing overburden element on the retail side at the city level. And then finally, the rural area example, and this is a net contributor, although almost a break-even type of community. The results are follow what we've seen before in the other types of communities on the residential side. On the non-residential side, this is akin to the developing community, where retail does not pay for itself in total, both at the city and county level, not in total, and at the office level, essentially breaking even. Industrial does cover its cost. Eliminating the program does not flip the retail. Retail is still in total an overburden in this community. Office has a higher net surplus. Industrial continues to be a net surplus and does not show an overburden.
Mr. Lind, could you, I mean, what is sort of the net of the point you're making here? I mean, this is complicated. So are you, the distribution, I mean, if you could summarize sort of what you're saying about overburden, underburden, and what we need to think about. What are the policy considerations?
Sure. So one of the questions early on in discussing the program is, is there sufficient revenue generated with the program off of commercial industrial land uses within the communities, particularly the contributor communities, that to cover the expenses that are generated off those land uses? And toward that end, we did this very detailed fiscal analysis, maybe ended up too in the weeds in terms of the overall, but you sort of had to get to that level to roll it back up to say, you know, is there, quote unquote, an overburden? And the overburden meaning, are there revenues, you know, are there direct revenues from these land uses that are sufficient to cover their direct impacts, their costs? In total, every community has a mix of land uses. Some subsidize others. I mean, it's just, you know, local budgets, the way local budgets work, and you have to balance your balance your budget at the end of the day, and you're going to have some that are contributed and some that receive. I mean, the school district is a perfect example where you have, for the most part, you know, residential development that's generating the costs, not potentially not covering their direct costs at the local level, but non-residential development is subsidizing the school impacts. And so because this program affects every governmental level, city, county, schools, and special districts included, that the question then becomes, well, you know, looking, you can't really just look at the city piece, you need to look at all of the other levels of government. And so this is really, I would think, sort of the first step in terms of understanding or getting to this overburden question. It's interesting, and I make the point about, you know, the local government aid and the county program aid includes an overburden calculation in the formula, but fiscal disparities doesn't. And, you know, the reasons for that is, you know, I don't know, but there is no there's no overburden or service or needs provision in the fiscal disparities equation as it stands now, or the formula. There is on the LGA and the county program aid side, and that analysis has been done.
Representative Lemchesky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, to that point, and I'm glad you asked a question about that, Madam Chair, because I think the last comment, you know, the contributor cities, if you look at LGA or CPA, as was stated, you know, there's a factor in those formulas that says, look, you know, you're Rochester or you're Moorhead, so you're going to get extra money because you have these overburden needs because all these other people come into your community, so you have more traffic and you have people using your libraries and parks and whatever. In fiscal disparities, there's nothing like that. So if you take a city like mine that has 100,000 people walking around the Mall of America on a Saturday, and, you know, across the corridor, we're a huge job center. You know, we have the largest we have more hotel beds per night than Minneapolis-St. Paul combined, and just lots of big office parks. And we don't get a bump in the formula because everyone's coming into Bloomington every day. And I think that the contributor communities have argued for a long time that's really unfair, that when 40% of our commercial industrial tax base is being shipped around, you know, maybe it should be 10. And I think what all these charts really show is some kinds of land use really are, we're losing money on them. I mean, if you're a mayor in a contributing city or any mayor in the metro, you ought to be saying, I don't want any retail. They clearly don't pay their own weight, and all these charts show that. And so, for example, in the fiscal disparities formula, you take the Mall of America. They're not beginning from a city perspective. This is why I always say to people, if you like it so much, I wish you would take it to your city. We lose money on the deal. Who gets money on the Mall of America? The state. Gets state income tax and state sales tax that everybody in the state benefits from, but the city is losing money. It isn't beginning to cover its costs, and then you add fiscal disparities, and I have a little handout that I'd like, if I could, to pass to the committee just to look at their leisure, that shows that in the city of Bloomington, for every commercial industrial property dollar, city of Bloomington gets 12 cents. So every time we tax a business a dollar in Bloomington, we get 12 cents. So we don't begin to take back to cover our costs for a place like the Mall of America. And I think it's relevant to think about all these things. You know, the other people are getting a really good deal in our low-valued homes. I mean, they're not paying their own weight either. Low-valued homes, but retail really isn't. I mean, it's just really hard to argue why anybody should want more Home Depots and Targets and Walmarts and Malls of America, which we have all that stuff. We're losing money on that. But I think the reason that a lot of the contributor cities feel the way they feel is that it's hard to watch your tax base get shipped to everyone else. It'd be one thing if you had extra to spare, but when you're not even getting your retail facilities covered in the tax system, that just means your homeowners have to pay that. And I think it's really relevant this year, Madam Chair, because I know you're going to hear the tax increment financing bills at some point this year, and indeed the chair of the tax committee has a bill for Bloomington that I oppose strongly, which says we should give the Mall of America more subsidy, 25 more years of subsidy, and in fact, they don't even pay their own weight. So this stuff really does all matter when people actually break down. And if you can see, if you're a mayor, you want to get one of those you know, big office buildings, but you don't want the Mall of America. Or you want a high-valued home, but you don't want a small, low-valued home. Or you want a condo, but you don't. And that's the kind of stuff we don't normally delve into. But from a development purpose, Madam Chair, you oversee lots of bills, and so does the chair of the full committee, that give more subsidies to developments. And you have to kind of ask why when you look at some of this information. So I appreciate you brought it up. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Rulin, did you want to conclude? Or are we just about to that point?
Yep.
Okay.
We have a couple more slides. I think we covered. I covered this. I appreciate the comments, and that's those are the takeaways from that part of the analysis. In terms of the policy considerations or some of the issues and thoughts, we just touched on this in terms of the overburden, the spending component in the formula. And as Representative Lincheski noted, it depends on the type of property, the level of government, the local situation in terms of current levels of service, what kinds of levels of service are provided in these different types of communities. But the point also is that there are precedent in terms of the LGA and the CPA formula where there is a needs component included in there. We have a discussion in the full report on that piece and the factors that go into that. And so there is accommodation for that in those formulas. The program equalizes tax base and tax rates, especially in the non-rural parts of the metro area. And then without it, we've shown that the rural area rates would increase and approach the metro average. The metro rural growth areas, growth centers, excuse me, would increase, but are already higher than the metro average. The question about the effect on business location decisions, we talked about this earlier on too, in terms of the migration out of the metro core. This is trends, it tracks with what's happened elsewhere in the United States. The question with the program, would this be further exacerbated or potentially would the opposite occur given the changes in the tax rates? And again, we've had lots of internal discussions about this, and happy to elaborate offline on our thoughts. Without the program, more jurisdictions would see an increase in tax rates rather than a decrease. Without the programs, jurisdictions that would see those decreases in rates have primarily been the job growth centers in the past. And that it is important to remember, and we've discussed this at different points today, about that the fiscal disparities program works within the system of revenue structures, aids, and policies, and so making changes to that would have ripple effects for other aid programs. Potential areas for future research, I would say there's a lot. It's a 40-year program. One of the quotes in the paper was, you know, the most intense scrutiny the program has seen since, and so there's a lot that could be done. And hopefully this is a start. But the question at the local level, and this question has been raised about, you know, does it make sense for localities to pursue commercial industrial development? If so, you know, should there be incentives? You know, we haven't talked about TIF, tax increment financing. This is obviously a tool used very frequently and readily. Does it make sense in the grand scheme of things at the local level, and does it make sense at a regional level? And again, this question of it depends, answers vary by jurisdiction in each particular situation. Is there infrastructure available? Is it good infrastructure? You know, do you have brownfields that you need to clean up?
Ms. Rulin, to that point, sure. How did you allocate costs when you came to looking at different types of development?
So what we do is we do a model, fiscal modeling, and look at individual cost centers with budgets for these case study jurisdictions, and in some cases if they're wholly allocated to residential development, park type costs, they're allocated to residential. If they're residential and non-residential, we do call proportionate share in terms of allocating to residential and non-residential, and then have factor residential and non-residential, and then have factors that are driven off of, so a retail development, you know, employees per square foot. What's the demand from the employment base there? What's the demand from the trips, the vehicle trips? So roads are allocated by vehicle trips. Our Appendix F, which is another separate document, shows all of the assumptions for each of the case studies jurisdictions of our approach, the revenue and costs factors and the output. So by each land use type, the revenues and costs off of each of from each line item in the budgets for each of the jurisdictions and for each of the jurisdictions and for each level of government for each of those jurisdictions.
Okay. Was that your conclusion, or are you?
And just in terms of the, just wrapping, rounding out the future research, you know, if the key issue is business location and competition among localities, then specific research could be done at the on the tax rate effect at a local level. But it does become this modeling at the local level, and then the homestead burden analysis has just so far looked at medians. You know, what would happen if the program were undone at the extremes, the low level and the high levels. And that does conclude the presentation. Thank you for your time.
Very good. Mr. Ouellette, did you have any closing comments? Okay. We probably have some folks in the I'm sorry, we have a question. Representative Barrett, did you have your questions?
Sure. Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a few questions, real simple questions. Somebody mentioned that it was originally a 5-county participation and it moved to 7 counties. When did that happen and why did that happen?
Mr. Ouellette.
Madam Chair and Representative Barrett, it's not that the program has always been a 7-county program. The point made at the beginning was that at the time the program was created, the census definition of what was a metro area was only 5 counties. Since then, the census definition of the Twin Cities metropolitan area has grown to 13 counties, 2 of which are in Wisconsin. So that discussion was just illustrating how much development has occurred since the creation of the program and how the development has spilled way beyond the boundaries of the program.
And thank you, Mr. Ouellette. And that's the nature of my question. Being a outer ring semi-rural area, Chisago County, right on the fringe, on the outside of this, I'm struggling to determine whether this is a good thing or a bad thing as it relates to the many other things the state and the regional area does, including Metropolitan Council. So considering the fact that Chisago County has a very low commercial industrial tax base because of many reasons, not the least of which is competition with Wisconsin that has half the property tax rates that we do for commercial industrial, trying to determine whether adding Chisago and other counties is smart politically, but more importantly smart from a policy perspective. It certainly is part of the metro area. Certainly we have many of our residents commuting down to the Twin Cities for jobs. And so I wonder if you could tackle that question.
Ms. Herland or Mr. Ouellette?
Madam Chair and Representative Barrett, I don't think I could comprehensively answer it. That's a very tough question. But I would begin by observing that, one of the main points of the program is to minimize the competition or to reduce the incentive to compete for commercial development by sharing a portion of the tax base that's created throughout the whole metro area. So the answer to the question you kind of first have to ask, is Chisago competing for the same businesses that Scott County is? I mean, is the bigger metro area really one place that all businesses could locate anywhere? Or is it submarkets? I mean, if it's really one cohesive unit, and a business is deciding between Chisago and the far south of the metro area, then you could think about whether it's in the interest of the entire larger region to disincent going after that development and letting it. Letting communities choose not to develop and still gain some proceeds from the development that happens elsewhere.
Madam Chair, Mr. Ouellette, that was the nature of my original question of the 5-county versus 7-county and why 7 and whether 7 is the right number. You talked about it probably not being a good idea to eliminate it, but certainly that doesn't mean that 7 counties is a magical number, especially since it's been 32 years or 31 years since it was created with apparently 7 counties initially, and we have more population, probably doubled in 30 years. I don't know, maybe not quite that much, but certainly the metropolitan area is bigger. But certainly we wouldn't want the burden of the Metropolitan Council, I don't believe, in our county. So I wondered what that relationship is to this program and whether they're mutually exclusive or interrelated, either in actuality or in practice.
Representative Barrett, was that a?
That's a question. Yeah, okay. Are they related? What other burdens are there on a county number 8 or 9 or 10 or 11 that we haven't talked about today?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Barrett, I specialize in property taxes, so I'm dipping my toe into waters that I'm not as familiar with. But the Met Council and the Fiscal Disparities Program were created at about the same time, and both had as part of their objective guiding development in a more orderly fashion for the seven county metro area. It may be worth hearing from the Met Council how they view the activities they do to guide development, and whether it would make sense to have a fiscal disparities program that has different boundaries than their activities. Because they both are trying to achieve some of the same ends. The Met Council does things to preserve open space, and that was one of the goals of the fiscal disparities program as well.
Representative Barrett?
Thank you. Oh, let me just add that my good friend, Representative Crawford, corrected me. It's been 40 years since I'm 71 and 72. I should know that, but it's early in the morning.
Okay, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for you. On page number 14 of your power slides, it says that all rural growth centers are net recipients in 2011, as they were in 1976. I believe that there are some cities in my district that are not recipients, receive no LGA, and if that's the case, is that contradictory to report, or am I not understanding that last sentence?
Ms. Erland?
Mm-hmm. This reflects the net recipients of the fiscal disparities program, so that they're receiving more than they're contributing into the fiscal disparities program, apart from the LGA program. So this is just taking those communities that are labeled as rural growth centers by, it is the Met Council's definitions, and really to categorize by type of community. All of those communities that are categorized within that category are net recipients of in the program.
I would add, Madam Chair, there are two types of classifications for rural areas. Mm-hmm. There's rural growth centers and rural areas, and there's a mix within one of those groups. The rural areas has both contributors and recipients. So in the full report in the appendix, there's a list of every city and what their classification is. So you can look at it that way. And I have it here if you have specific questions about cities you want me to answer.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then, I'll look at that that chart as well. Just wondering, maybe you can answer this. For some rural cities, then, that don't receive any fiscal disparities or LG, are we net contributors then? Are some of our commercial industrial contributors, or you're just pertaining to the seven county metropolitan area?
Mr. Willett?
Madam Chair and Representative McDonald, the cities outside of the seven county metro area don't directly participate in the program unless they're on the Iron Range, which has its own fiscal disparities program. There's indirect impacts through LGA that we discussed that would affect cities anyway outside of the metropolitan area. Townships don't participate in the LGA program.
Representative McDonald?
Madam Chair, thank you. And then lastly, I have a little parochial question, and this is my mayor's question from the old days. I see that this report is very valuable, and I can see the necessity for it, especially as lawmakers and staff to be able to compilate this and put it together for some future good legislation. And my apologies, though, I must say, I see the report cost close to $100,000, $96,000, $151,000. What are we able to do with this? Can this pay for itself? And do we do this every year? Or is it every 5 years? So how is this able to help us and pay for itself in the long run?
Mr. Willett?
Madam Chair and Representative McDonald, thank you for the question. This is what I consider a research, sort of a foundational document. This will help us help you have the policy debate about whether you want to make changes to the program. It doesn't answer the questions themselves, but I think the question about the overburden for retail is going to be really helpful when you grapple with whether you want to make changes to should there be a need component for communities or other questions. Should the grandfathering of the 71 base be looked at? Should the 40% threshold be considered? The report was not asked to make recommendations. The legislation specifically stayed away from that, so it doesn't do that. But it does attempt to provide background information that we can look at when you get into more specific questions about the program. So I do hope that it will provide a lot of value when this committee and other committees want to engage on specific changes to the program.
Representative McDonald?
And yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, it is very valuable as I see it. It's a lot to take in, but in the closing pages, it has a summary that's very helpful as well as to why the program was started. How often is this done?
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, I'm sorry, I forgot that question. A study like this has not been done before. The analysis of how taxes would shift without the program, that portion has been done before, including several times by Steve Hines, your able researcher. But the Voss analysis is new, and we do hope to expand that piece. And the case study cost analysis has not been done before. So those pieces are completely new.
To that point, Ms. Schill?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, just to clarify the $100,000 cost for this study, we in law, met council pay for this, and it actually came from their livable communities fund, that $100,000. So you didn't see that come out of Department of Revenue's budget or other places. It came from Met Council.
Great, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Ouellette.
It came from the same source as the Livable Communities Fund. It came from an extra distribution of the pool, but it didn't reduce the amount of money for the Livable Communities Fund.
All right. Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Quick question for you. Are we going to have time to make general comments before we adjourn today, or do you want general comments now? Are we going to
Representative Dietrich, why don't you go ahead and make a statement?
Okay. First of all, I would like to ask a question. The comment was made that Anoka County's property taxes went down, and yet they are a net recipient of fiscal disparities. So what my question is there a mechanism in the fiscal disparities equation that adjusts them for their amount of fiscal disparities then in the future because of that property tax decrease?
Mr. Ouellette.
Madam Chair, Representative Dietrich, there is sort of a feedback loop because the distribution levies are based on the previous year's local tax rate. So if they reduce their levy and that reduces their levy, that will impact their following year fiscal disparities.
Okay, thank you very much.
Senator Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just another comment. We were also talking a little bit about comparing or looking at fiscal disparities in the lens of the counties, and I think that is extremely dangerous because I think what fiscal disparities did was it took the cities, the school districts, and the counties and looked at some real characteristics of those communities. And so, for example, and I think that was in made of the context for Hennepin County versus Anoka County, and I think that I can look at that in a more unique sense because I represent Hennepin County and Anoka County. And first of all, county to county, there's huge differences in property wealth, property use. Anoka County has a lot of wetlands, a lot of other challenges that has restrictions. Actually, they have 600, in case you guys didn't know it, they have 600 acres of school trust lands in their county. And I don't think Bloomington area has any school trust lands. No, they did, but the airport's on them. Thank you. And I bet they got a good deal on that land. And so, anyhow, there is a big difference between, so I can look at my Hennepin County voters and say, did you know some of your money might be going to Anoka County? But you know what? We look at ourselves as one because of our school district. We have the Anoka-Hennepin School District that covers both counties. And so that would be really pitting our kids against each other, and that doesn't do anybody any good. And then you have to look at cities. Our cities are so totally different. We happen to be a very small city moderate-sized city in Hennepin County, and we could start questioning, do our county taxes pay for some of the services in Minneapolis? And so I think once you go down this path, it is a very slippery slope. And so I just wanted to make that general comment. And then I have one other question. Does the this question was asked in context of Minneapolis and St. Paul, but does that pre-71 exemption of property wealth apply to all the areas that are in the fiscal disparities program?
Mr. Ouellette?
Madam Chair, Representative Dietrich, it does. It has the biggest impact where the communities were most fully developed in 1971 because they've had less new growth. Now, Minneapolis has had a lot of redevelopment and additional towers downtown, but yes, it's all jurisdictions have that grandfather if they had commercial industrial in 71.
Right. So there might be a correlation to those areas that had great property wealth before 71 and whether they are. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And just to that last point, I don't remember, is there any inflation factor in the base, or is the 1971 base just locked in time and what it was in 71?
Mr. Ouellette.
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, there's not an inflation factor. There are adjustments for class rate changes and other law changes that would change how you would measure what the base was in 71, but it's the actual dollar. So the fact that valuations have inflated over the last 40 years have made that grandfather less significant than it was earlier in the program.
And does that mean that Mr. if there Loeffler? Was, thank you, Madam Chair, if there was a building in 1971, that was worth, say, $150,000. Is its value in 2012 $150,000 in the base? So, I mean, all that inflation in the value is actually captured into the pool then as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, that's correct.
Okay. That's helpful to know. The other question I was going to ask is, I've always heard, and I wasn't around when this was done, most of us probably weren't paying any attention to tax policy back in the 70s. were not born. But I had heard that it was actually came about in part because there was such intense competition over regional facilities, not about normal shopping centers and office buildings and factories. It was about there was going to be a new airport in the metro. And everyone assumed that to grow, we would have to have a second airport, and whoever had got that second airport would be as successful as Bloomington. Or, that the new zoo was going to be this huge tourist attraction like Disney World, and wherever that got located would be like Orlando. And, that was kind of the context. And, is anything in your research kind of showed that really made any difference? I can't think of any big, big regional facility that's been added since then except the Mega Mall, and the Gurmasians picked that site, I suspect, because of the airport, not because of anything we've been talking about. But, did you look at that aspect at all, or am I right that it was really about that competition for big investments?
Ms. Herland.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. There's some bit of anecdotal element to the project, to the research, and so that was a point that was raised, and some of the literature does identify that as an impetus for the program. The other piece of the puzzle in terms of impetus, not so much has been written about it, I don't recall, in terms of the school funding piece of the school funding where prior to the shift to state, the funding coming predominantly from state funding, where it was locally driven, that places without the commercial industrial tax base weren't able to fund the schools to the level. So there are different elements in terms of the origin story, the stories of how it came about, the piece in terms of the regional facilities, I mean, as you said, there's lots of other factors that go into play, some of which are more important in terms of the reasons behind the location. And first and foremost is the access, infrastructure, the transportation network. particularly for those types of facilities. So it's more anecdotal as opposed to quantitative on that piece of the equation.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to say I agree with everything Representative Dietrich said, of course, as usual.
As usual, thank you.
And I just want to say, for the record, I'd be willing to consider a trade if we could just move the 94 loop to run through Coon Rapids, have a junction with Interstate 35, and somewhere in between that we could place the International Airport. I'd be all for talking about taking away fiscal disparities for my community.
Very good. Any other questions from the members? Okay. We do have a couple minutes. I don't know if there's anyone in the audience pressing to make a comment. But we do have a couple of folks who came, I guess, the hopes they could make a comment. Mike Gamachi with the Metro Mayors Association. Okay, and we do have a few other folks as well, Mr. Gamachi, so you can summarize, hopefully. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please give us your name and who you represent.
Thank you, Chair. Chair Rumbeck, members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Mike Gamache. I have served as the mayor of the city of Andover for 11 years now and employed at General Mills. I also serve as the president of the North Metro Mayors Association. And I'm here today to testify on the study of the Metropolitan Area Fiscal Disparities Program. Quickly, the North Metro Mayors Association was established in 1987 as a joint powers organization to advocate for private and public economic and policy interests of our member cities. Our current membership includes 17 cities. Anoka and Hennepin County, and numerous private sector partners. We believe that the program has been a significant success for our cities and our property taxpayers. This is more significant today given that our cities have had a greater loss of total tax capacity than other metro and greater Minnesota cities due to the weakened economy and housing markets. Brooklyn Center and Crystal, for example, have seen their total tax capacity drop by 20% from 2008 to 2011. Compared to 7% for all Minnesota cities. Fiscal disparities helps overcome this challenge. In a very real sense, it takes an entire region to foster economic development. That is one reason to applaud the current efforts to think as a region on job creation and competition with other regions. But local governments throughout the region bear the cost of successful economic development regardless of where the development happens to be located. The city in which it is located bears the costs associated with property services such as police and fire. But the workers going to the development every day they live and commute from other cities throughout the area. Without fiscal disparities, these cities have limited ability to recoup at least a portion of these costs as all new property tax revenues would go to the host community. One can go down the list of the original purposes of the fiscal disparities program and know that they have been maintained and achieved. Charlie Weaver would be proud. For example, one goal that was labeled to provide orderly development. This goal is addressed on page 14 of the author's report. Half of the developed cities are now contributors and half are recipients. That wasn't the case when the program began. Another goal listed is equity in distribution of fiscal resources. The last paragraph on page 19 addresses this success, showing that a small distribution makes a significant difference for recipients. Our North Metro Mayor's focus is mostly city finances, but it must be remembered the fiscal disparities program also impacts school districts, counties, and other taxing districts. Consequently, impacts on individual households and taxpayers may be significantly different if we only look at city outcomes. As noted throughout the report, there are many complicated and interdependent factors at work driving how, when, and where growth occurs. We suggest that the legislature defer fiscal disparity program changes this year, accept the study, and to assess the findings over the next year before making any changes. We also suggest that any changes be considered in the light of other proposals to address the market value homestead credit changes, LGA changes, and other property tax system reforms. We stand ready and willing to work with the legislature, the governor, and other local officials to make our public financial structure simpler, more transparent, and targeted to better address the citizens and the business needs. In the interest of time, we'll cut our comments short. This is the long 200-page program or report that you received, but I want to thank you for the opportunity to address the committee, and we stand ready to answer any questions that you may have. Also with me today is Patricia Nauman from Metro Cities. I believe she has some comments as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gamache. Ms. Nauman?
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, my name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, for the organization that represents cities in the 7-county metropolitan area before both the legislature and Metropolitan Council. As you can imagine, there's a very keen interest in our members in the fiscal disparities program and a keen interest in this study. Our policies have long supported the fiscal disparities program and have also long opposed any specific programs being funded by the fiscal disparities pool. Using our policies as a backdrop, and while I'm not in a position today to forecast what, if any, policy changes our organization might undertake as a result of this report, I do expect that the study will provide very useful information and analysis for our organization going forward as we determine what, if any, policies we might want to develop around this program in the future. We will, of course, also be watching very closely what the legislature might do with regard to this program as a result of this report. And to that end, I would encourage you to undertake any discussions within and any proposed changes within a context, as Ms. Herlins mentioned, that this program functions within. It functions within a larger system of aids and credits and other policies. And we would encourage you to have any discussions within that context, as well as keeping in mind the overall benefits and overall health of the metropolitan region and the state. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And I believe we have County Commissioner Sivaraja. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rhonda Sivaraja, and I'm the chair of the Anoka County Board of Commissioners. I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to us today. As the study discovered, there's no program in the country and probably in the world like fiscal disparities. And to truly understand the importance of fiscal disparities, I think it's important to look at the political culture at the time it was developed. The Twin Cities and the legislature were a much different place 40 years ago. In 1971, there was actually no political designation on the ballot. Overall, though, unless you represented the core cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, you represented a community that was much like the rest, sparsely populated and struggling to grow and develop an identity. This is at a time when 70% of the metro's population still lived in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. Over the years, growth tended to gravitate in the areas where the state made large infrastructure investments in transportation. The communities who are considered net contributors still keep 60% of the growth in their commercial industrial tax base. Studies have shown that the amount contributed does not place an unfair burden on those communities. And it's important to note, although the study focused on the impact on cities and counties, school districts are also impacted. So in Anoka County, for example, even though the city of Blaine is a net contributor, actually their taxpayers end up being net recipients because of Anoka County and the school district in which they live. We understand that Anoka County actually plays two key roles within the metropolitan area. We are primarily a bedroom community with an important role in helping to supply a part of the workforce. And in order for our region to be able to compete in a global economy, that workforce does need to be educated. So making sure that we have the resources necessary to be able to provide core services for schools as well as critical. Another element, and maybe more important to consider, is the impact of natural resources, something we're very proud of in Minnesota. Without fiscal disparities, many communities would be forced to forego their natural resources to pursue economic development. In Anoka County, I cannot overstate the importance of this. We actually are a key element for the entire Twin Cities water supply. Let me explain. Anoka County has three rivers, more than 143 lakes, and more than 75,000 acres of wetland within our 444 square miles. That moist and sandy soil that we have is like a giant sieve, and beneath it is a giant aquifer. It takes about 10 years for one drop of water to reach to the aquifer. That sand plain aquifer is the largest supplier of our Twin Cities groundwater. We are upstream, and we are your water supply. Severe changes to fiscal disparities or elimination altogether could mean rush development in order to support public services. That means more pavement, which would increase runoff into our primary waterway, the Mississippi River. The Mississippi would then take that runoff downstream and out of the Twin Cities. It would never reach that supply of groundwater that is so critical to all of us.
Commissioner, I'm going to probably have to cut you off.
That's okay. And so finally, I guess I just want to, again, thank you very much for your time, and just want to emphasize the point again that we play a very important role in the region and look forward to working with you in the days ahead, and would just ask that you not make changes to the fiscal disparities program in isolation. Would encourage you to look at comprehensive property tax reform, because as Representative Lincheski so well pointed out, what you do in one area has huge effects on the rest of the state as well.
Thank Very good. Thanks so much. I'm going to apologize to those who wanted to speak. We don't have time. Committee is adjourned.